What is your, how much knowledge do you have of the extent to which raids purely for the purpose of dominating no man's land were carried out, as opposed to the kind of raids you've just described, where specific objectives like identification of units would be the target?
Only to the extent that when we were in sectors like Montenegro, we always had patrols out moving at night, not always, but as a rule, usually to cover work going on and prevent the Boche doing the same. I think the kind of raid you're thinking of occurred much more on Salonika and distant, where there's a big gap in between, and where a lot could happen in between without anyone knowing about it, unless you did have it patrolled thoroughly.
So in your experience, there wasn't too much activity of the kind which would just be designed to keep the Germans occupied.
I think that as war goes on and you're dealing in human lives and ammunition and all materials, and you've got to conserve with the purpose of the main effort, all that comes into it. And so you don't expend human lives unless there's a purpose to it. I think that's a point we've sometimes forgotten. You don't just raid for the sake of raiding, you raid with a purpose.
Yes, I think that is a point which often,
Yes.
which doesn't come over in a great many of the
Well,
written
that
histories.
really is so. Well, I heard of specific.
Did you at any time throughout the war ever consider the possibility that Britain and her allies might lose?
I don't think seriously, no. Any more than one did when I came out of Dunkirk, when you really were in a mess. But one never really believed it was possible. I think it's just one of those things one just felt it couldn't happen. It may have been foolish, but that was rather the attitude, I think. Although, I think after the German offensive in 1918, people were a bit worried. But I personally never felt that.
Yes. Now
Yeah,
you're.
I didn't mean to say you were overconfident. You just
No.
somehow never, somehow occurred to me you ever would lose.
Now you were involved in the final operations in 1918. I wonder whether in November, when the armistice was actually declared, whether the ending of the war came as a surprise to the active soldiers.
Not then, because you see, we'd then been advancing from the Hindenburg Line for about 2 months, and the Hindenburg Line was crossed about the middle of September 1918, which is a sort of rarely impregnable line. And we then got into more open country, and I myself was knocked out east of the Hindenburg Line on the northeast of St. Quentin. And from then onwards, it was much more steady advance, although the Boche naturally held you up everywhere. But I think that the troops all expected the end of war to come fairly soon, the actual timing, of course. And in England, one certainly did.
When the war actually did come to an end, I mean immediately after the war came to an end, were there any particular kinds of celebrations which you can remember?
Well, I personally was in hospital in London, and
Okay.
all I remember is going out to some other chaps and going around the streets, seeing all the cheering crowds and having a jolly good dinner somewhere.
Do you think your experiences in the war changed you in any important ways?
Oh, I think that gave a bit more self-confidence and brought out your character a bit if you hadn't had.
In the years immediately following the First World War, did you notice any particular changes in the country as a result of the war?
I think that we all rather expected that the general atmosphere would go back very much to pre-1914, which was then, I suppose, for so-called privileged classes, was a very pleasant life. I don't think it was too unpleasant for the ordinary chaps in villages and so on. But none of us envisaged the development of aircraft or really the motor car, which was very much its infancy at the beginning of the war, and nor the tremendous difference that a world at arms, chaps from who lived all their lives in villages and then shot into a world and quite different, going back, the different set effect make, and doubtless started quite a social change, which, of course, you saw a very much greater change in 1945 onwards.
Did you notice particularly any changes in people's attitudes?
You mean to each other or what?
To anything at all, really. I mean, some of the things which one hears a lot about are the sort of complete disillusionment with war and a certain amount of bitterness about...
Well, there inevitably is that, because unemployment was very bad. And I wasn't personally involved very much in this because I went abroad again, you see, with a regular battalion in October 1919, when demobilisation was still not complete. I think there's, as I mentioned afterwards, later on, I learnt much more about it when, as I did, I became involved in the British Legion and learnt how much disillusioned there had been in the chaps who came out and expected to have a world of heroes and found that they were not really getting much of a deal.
Do you remember any details of any of the big celebrations in London or anywhere else that accompanied the end of the war?
Well, yes, because I personally took part in the victory marches both in Paris and London. Paris was on the anniversary of the Bastille on 14th July, and then in London on 19th of July. What happened was that a combined colour parties of the senior battalion of every regiment and cavalry regiments were formed into one unit, and they were assembled at Folkestone under the Brigade Guards Colonel, from whence we were to go over to Paris and take part as a solid mass of British Army colours marching past as a solid phalanx. Well, this is actually what did happen, but not entirely according to plan, in that we assembled at Folkestone and all was well there. A colour party consisted of an infantry battalion of two officers and three NCOs who had mostly been decorated. And we all went fitted out with our best clothes and all this kind of thing, which we carefully had packed up not to be used until the great day. And over we went from Folkestone to Boulogne. When we got to Boulogne, we found there was some bother about our train. The train which was supposed to be ready for us wasn't. And after being switched from a number of platforms, we eventually did get sent off to Paris by some slow train, which took nearly 24 hours to get from Boulogne to Paris. All our kit, special kit, had been left on the wrong platform, and we only saw it again after we got back to England. No arrangements had been made for feeding, and so we stopped the train when we passed Expeditionary Force canteens, which we then proceeded to raid and get our own food.
How did you stop it?
Well, by just telling someone to pull the communication and the guard. It was trundling along by 50 miles an hour. This is post-war France, mind you, and things were very disorganized. They went hurling through the countryside as they are today. We duly arrived in Paris and were ferried by lorries out to the Bois de Boulogne, where only 48 hours before, a labour company from somewhere in France, because they were all over the place mopping up, you see, the debris of the war, had been sent up to organise a camp. Well, they'd managed to put up a number of tents. And there were literally no other arrangements of any kind at all, except a few bedboards. And officers, with a large crowd of Parisians coming out to watch, literally had to walk down to the Seine carrying latrine buckets, luckily new ones, in order to fetch water to wash in. The feeding arrangements were on the same level. But when it came to the great day, I remember very well, we marched with the Arc de Triomphe about 8 o'clock in the morning, a lovely summer's day. The French then wearing their horizon bleu, which was then their colour, not khaki. And looking along the Champs-Élysées was simply magnificent. It was all lined with this lovely sort of blue-grey colour and thousands of people. And it was quite an impressive spectacle, these mass colours of the British Army. We happened to be on the outer flank, about three colour parties in line, or four in line, and all the pretty girls ran out and sort of kissed the lucky chaps on the outside and said, voila les couleurs, les clés battu. Well, they'd all been in their depots all the time, that didn't matter. And round we went, and we had a most wonderful reception. And afterwards, when we fell out, my fellow officer and I and some chaps and Welsh fusiliers who was went off to a little tavern on the river to get a soft drink because it was very hot. And as we went in, we realised something was amiss. There was a chap sitting down. They played every national anthem under the sun. He wouldn't stand up. So eventually we had to stand and salute all this time. And they said, look at these Anglais. And they finished up by carrying this wretched chap and pitching him to the Seine. Well, that finished that. That was a sort of atmosphere of élan. Then back we went to London, where we were billeted beautifully in various barracks around London. We formed up in some side street off Hyde Park in the early morning. And there we had to wait some time, so we piled arms and laid our colours across them and had allowed a fall out by the chap commanding. The door opened, and a very distinguished-looking chap, who afterwards turned out to be Marcus Lincoln, came out and said, oh, you chaps must want something. Come on in. And to the horror of the latecomers, discovered that he was handing out champagne, whiskey, anything to the gang, to all this party. It was 8 o'clock in the morning, just before they marched around London. We managed to persuade our chaps to go easy on that. And I think everybody did. Well, then we, after this, solicited tribute, we then marched around 7 miles around London, boiling day, all through Kennington, that part, where people, instead of rushing out and kissing you, rushed out with wads of seed cake on a plate and this sort of thing. I couldn't help, we all thought at the time, this is the most marvellous contrast to the British and French characters.
One, you got champagne, and the other one...
First of all, champagne, and then seed cake, and then France, lots of élan, but nothing much else. But it was a great experience and a great fun, of course.
That was. Now, I noticed that in July 17, you were wounded by shellfire. What do you remember about your treatment after the injury had been sustained?
Well, I only had a few rarely very minor scratches, but afterwards they did find a little bit of shell inside my jaw. I was sent to the field ambulance to have an antitetanus injection. When I got there, the MO said, I'm not quite sure about that place in your face. They were then clearing hospitals for an operation that was coming off. So I was sent back with other casualties to the base. When I got there, they said, oh, we can't help that, clearing all hospitals, back you go. The next thing I found myself was in a train driving up to going up to Victoria, my ambulance train, with the staff and nurses, and they came round. I was very young, I suppose, only just 18. Someone said, you can't go arrive like that with bits of sticking plaster in your face. Before I knew what had happened, they had tied me up in bandages. When we got to Victoria, walking wounded out, I was put in the first car by myself. And in those days, enormous crowd used to turn up to greet the hospital trains coming in. And as I drove out, I had a sort of, ooh, I've never felt such an ass in my life. Completely bogus.
After your period of convalescence in England, I presume you returned directly to France?
Because by that time they had brought in an age limit for sending young soldiers to an active front, and I was then only 18 and a half. I was sent to the, after two months leave, which was totally unnecessary, but I think out of the kindness of the heart of the board, I was sent to our reserve battalion, where I was launched into training as a machine gunner, which I enjoyed very much indeed. Until so, I was old enough to go back to France in the following spring.
So having already spent 5 months in France, you were prevented from being sent back for a second time because you were then regarded as too young.
It wasn't quite five, it was 2 months, but that was the fact, yes.
Now, when you went back to France for the second time, you were given this job as a battalion Lewis gun officer, at a time when Lewis guns has only just been introduced into France. Why was there a need to have a Lewis gun officer for the battalion, and what exactly was your job?
I think the necessity was that it was quite a new weapon. No one out there really had been trained in the use of a light machine gun, because we hadn't ever had one. We'd only had a Vickers machine gun, which has a fixed mounting, and the system of use is quite different. One is a glorified rifle, and the other is, in a way, a kind of reduced gun. So I was made the battalion Lewis gun officer primarily to coordinate and carry out the training of Lewis gun personnel and the maintenance of the weapons, and of advising the company commanders and others to whom they were allotted in their deployment and sighting and so on.
Did the introduction of the Lewis gun have a very significant effect on British Army's operations in 1915?
I don't think they would...